The seventh woe, Matthew 23, verses 27 and 28. In accordance with what goes before, this woe speaks of the spiritual death which reigns within as the whitened sepulchre. The outside may be all that one could desire. They appear religious before men, but the Master opens the cover and shows them to us as God sees them. What a contrast! The last, the eighth woe, Matthew 23, verses 29 through 33, is a return to the thought expressed in the first three. Their opposition to God is again emphasized, though with a veil which might hide it not only from themselves, but also from others. They honored the prophets, whom their fathers killed, building memorials in their name. Thus, they refused to be in any sense identified with the deeds of their ancestors, but the Lord identifies them with the death of the prophets, for their present opposition to the truth proved them to be just as their fathers. They themselves were witnesses to this fact. They would not only fill up the measure of the iniquity which had gone before, but they would increase it yet more and more. The Lord tells them that He, emphasizing His authority, would send them wise men, scribes, and prophets, and the old history would be repeated. In the face of the record of the ages past, that was a definite warning. They would follow in the footsteps of their fathers, thus making themselves heirs of all the unbelief and consequent guilt in the bloodshedding, which was crying out to God for vengeance from Abel, the first one killed, to Zechariah. Zechariah was slain in the very face of God at the altar where he had no doubt run for refuge. The allusion to Abel here proves that they are the full expression of Cain, the self-righteous son of Adam, who killed his brother Abel, figure of Christ, because his own works were evil and his brother's righteous. It is the seed of the devil, the blood of vipers, Matthew 23:33, whom he is addressing here, those who were about to bruise the heel of the seed of the woman, but in so doing he should bruise the head of the serpent, Genesis 3:15. It was at Calvary that Christ gave to Satan his deadly wound, while the people, who proved they were the serpent's offspring, gave the seed of the woman a temporary bruising. They were cast out of their inheritance and will never come into real possession of it again except as a new creation, the offspring of the seed of the woman. Now the loving, tender, compassionate heart, whose emotions have been pent up as he was calling all the woes of judgment upon those wicked leaders, breaks out in a bitter lament over the city which he loved, though it had rejected him, its rightful ruler. O Jerusalem, Jerusalem, thou that killest the prophets and stonest them which are sent unto thee, how often would I have gathered thy children together, even as a hen gathereth her chickens under her wings, and ye would not. Behold, your house is left unto you desolate. For I say unto you, ye shall not see me henceforth, till ye shall say, Blessed is he that cometh in the name of the Lord. Matthew 23, verses 37 through 39. Man had again listened to the old serpent instead of to God in the face of all his love and goodness to him. O Jerusalem, Jerusalem, how often would I have gathered thy chickens together as a hen gathereth her chickens or brood under her wings, and ye would not. They refused his sheltering care, so their house, no longer his house, is left to them desolate. For the desolator, the Antichrist, will enter and rule there. Their rejection of the true king leaves place for the abominations of desolation of whom Daniel spoke, and of whom we hear in the following chapter. Through that usurper they will be disciplined, and in judgment they will learn the preparation necessary to cry with broken and contrite hearts, Blessed is he that cometh in the name of the Lord. Psalm 118:26. Prophetic outline of the end time, Matthew chapters 24 and 25. And Jesus went out and departed from the temple, and his disciples came to him for to show him the buildings of the temple, Matthew 24, verse 1. In the present section under consideration, we have a most important as well as interesting prophetic study. Matthew, as consistent with the kingly phase of Christ's ministry, enters most fully into the subject. He presents Israel, the Jew, as the central figure upon the earth at that time, though part of the church is also viewed in veiled speech as being still present, Matthew 25. This very fact is what makes this portion difficult of interpretation. We do not readily see how it is possible that God should be again dealing with his ancient people and with the church at the same time. But when we remember that all the dispensations overlap one another, our vision is enlarged. All God's purposes toward his people begin to come to pass, but they occupy a period of time. For instance, Judah's captivity to Babylon was in three relays, as it were. A period of time intervened between the first deportation and the last. So, in the end of their captivity, there were in evidence the same successive stages. The people did not all come back at one time. We note the same fact again after Calvary, although the Jews had rejected Christ and he had rejected them. Yet it was a gradual casting out. There was a beginning immediately, but the end did not come until 71 AD when the city of Jerusalem was demolished and the temple destroyed. In that period of rejection of the Jew, God was beginning his dealings with another people, the church. The two purposes ran side by side for a time. Therefore, because of these precedents, we conclude he will do the same again. His rejection of the church, I say it advisedly, his rejection of the visible church will be gradual. He will be taking out from her cohorts of people, ranks of believers, at different intervals, while at the same time he commences his relationship with Judah. Finally, when he is ready to spew the false woman, Christendom, out of his mouth, the Jews will be ready to be grafted into their own olive tree, Romans 11:24. Now, with these few remarks relative to the subject, we will proceed. The disciples who come to the Lord and show him the temple with its glory and beauty are typical of the Jewish disciples in the end who will be in doubt as to the temple, which will be at that time in evidence. They will wonder what the outcome of all its grandeur will be. Note that the then standing temple was built by Herod as the governor over Judea, which is a figure of the temple in the end time. The end time temple will be built by the world to some extent, and the world's king will have his image there. This will all be set up by the world's prophet, both of them the seed of the serpent. The Master had stepped out of the temple as no longer owning it. Israel had made it, as he said, a robber's den. Therefore, and he says it without one tinge of regret, there shall not remain one stone upon another that shall not be thrown down. A temple built by the world he does not own, though its magnificence astonishes the carnal. In fact, this temple, which was in building 50 years, and was not yet complete, was the glory and boast of the people. Therefore, his words astonish and grieve them. They cannot understand his thoughts, which were so different from those of all other men, even as spiritual saints today are a mystery and a trial to the worldly-minded and the babes. But though the temple still charmed and drew them on, his words linger in their hearts. They are allured to with their power and mystery. As he sits upon the Mount of Olives, they come and inquire, "When shall these things be?" They also add two other questions which were as one in their mind. "Tell us, when shall these things be, and what shall be the sign of thy coming and of the end of the age?" not world, as in the Authorized Version. Matthew 24:3b. They are not referring to this Christian age, for of this they were ignorant. It was the age in which they lived that closed at Calvary, to which they allude. The present church period is as a parenthesis between the first and second comings of Christ, wherein God is doing a new thing, yet the oldest thing in his purpose with man. He is gathering a people out of which he is building the bride of the Lamb. This is a great mystery revealed to Paul, of which there is no hint here in this Olivet discourse. It was hidden from his disciples. They were altogether occupied with the setting up of the kingdom, that which concerned their own nations and interests. But the Lord's reply to their questions is of great length and assures them that the time is longer than they imagine, though still leaving it largely indefinite. Matthew 24, verses 4 through 31. The gospel of the kingdom was to be preached in all the world, and then shall the end be. Not the culmination of all things, but simply the end of the time of which they are inquiring. Furthermore, all that he teaches here as he sits upon the mount has reference to the same time and is in answer to their three questions and different phases concerning them. The very first words of his reply carry a warning against false Christs, of whom he says, "Many shall come in my name, saying, I am Christ, and shall deceive many." Matthew 24:5. The false prophet and the usurping king of the revived Roman Empire, the two beasts, Revelation 13, are especially in view, though there will be lesser stars, fallen ones, in evidence. Satan's power and deception will no doubt be most marked at that period. There will indeed be the need of discernment to detect the true from the false Christ. The following words of Jesus bear comfort, of which there will also be sore need in the midst of such perplexities and trials on every hand. He assures of troubles from which there is no deliverance. Wars and rumors of wars will come, Matthew 24, verses 6 and 7. But these are little things and are to cause no great anxiety, for the worst is later. The rumors will be followed by the reality. Nation shall rise against nation, and kingdom against kingdom, Matthew 24, 7. In other words, a world war with its awful consequences, famine, pestilence, as well as earthquakes, will follow. Some may say, well, these consequences have always been common to the earth, but here they have a most significant character, for they are the answer to the disciples' questions. As coming all together or shortly after one another, they are the beginning of sorrows or travail pains of the end, as though all nature was pressing on to the new birth, the regeneration of the world. It is indeed the time of travail. Suffering will be the lot of all in a most aggravated form. We read of a woman, the true Israel of God, travailing in labor pains until she is delivered. Revelation 12:2. This also is a vision of the same day of judgment which ushers in the great day of Christ's return. All creation has groaned and travailed, but that time will be the culmination of the groaning time of all creation. The sons of God are about to be revealed in glory, upon whose manifestation the whole creation is dependent for deliverance from bondage. Then will come special trials, accumulated persecutions, piled up terrific afflictions from even friend and kinfolk. It will be the time of the climax of everything evil and hateful. Giant forms of rancor and rebellion will dominate the earth. The saints need expect nothing less than the worst. The treatment the world gave to the Messiah will be intensified to the servants, for the enmity against God will be increasing. Their suffering will test the reality of their profession. There will be no church joiners then, no hangers-on for the sake of gain. The name of being a disciple of Jesus Christ will be the synonym of shame, of reproach, of exile, especially as relating to the Jews. Many will be stumbled and betray one another. False prophets will find a hearing and a following in those days. They will reap a rich harvest, but their rejoicing will be short-lived. They will have only a brief time, even as their leader, the devil, to enjoy their victory. But the trials and heart-breaking sorrows will overwhelm the most courageous. God will have apparently deserted the field. Satan will have his day. Evil men will have their day, their hatred waxing worse and worse. Consequently, the love of even the true disciples of Christ will wax cold. Many will be afraid to declare their sympathy with the faithful suffering remnant. But there is an end, praise God, and some will endure thereunto and never see death. They will be preserved blameless. This refers to physical preservation through all the time of awful tribulation, and be ready to receive Christ when he comes triumphant and glorious in his apparel and strength. This portion is the doing of that eventful week of Daniel 9:27. It answers to the same time of which the book of Revelation instructs, beginning at chapter 4. There we see the inspired writer caught up to heaven, where he beholds the united company of the full overcomers, ready to judge the world with the judge. There the Lamb is taking the book, referring to the things of the future, into his hands. But note that then he will be manifested immediately as corresponding with Christ in the Lamb character. We see Israel nationally again upon the scene, as witness the sealed ones out of all her tribes, Revelation 7. Then, as soon as the seals are opened, the figures which appear upon the scene in answer to the call of the living ones are strikingly similar to what we have here in this great prophecy given on Mount Olivet. First, under the first seal, we have what answers to the false Christ and his conquest in the wilderness or world, that is, nationally, as well as the Christ in the secret place, that is, religiously. The true Christ warns of both of them. The second seal gives us the symbol of war of which we have the prophecy here. The third seal presages famine. The fourth seal, pestilence. The opening of the fifth seal discloses a great martyrdom which perfectly agrees with our Lord's words in this message. Then shall they deliver you up to be afflicted, and shall kill you, and ye shall be hated of all nations for my name's sake. Matthew 24:9. Notice that it is the hatred of nations against the nation of Israel, the Jew, that is emphasized. There is also an earthquake, maybe both literal and national, under the opening of the fifth seal. With the sixth seal, the book is further opened, and then we may readily see the very prophecies of Daniel to which the greater prophet here alludes beginning to be fulfilled. The latter part of the determined week of unparalleled tribulation of Daniel 9:27 is again and again in its different phases brought before us. The middle of that week of 7 years of magnificent prophecy in Daniel 9:27 is plainly marked, as is also the beginning of the Great Tribulation and the place of its most aggressive execution by the reference to the abomination of desolation that is standing in the holy place, Matthew 24:15. That is the most important epoch of the 7 years. The 3.5 years which precede are simply preparatory. The 3.5 years which follow are the result. Daniel foretold of that momentous event and same abomination, Daniel 11:3, and the disciples are here warned to flee from Judea when that prophecy is fulfilled. We have a further commentary on this subject by Paul, where we are informed of the man of sin sitting in the temple of God, showing himself that he is God, 2 Thessalonians 2:4. Then we find a symbol of the same evil one in the beast which John saw coming up out of the sea, the nations, figuring a world ruler, Revelation 13. There was given unto him a mouth speaking great things and blasphemies, Revelation 13:5. He is seen boldly declaring himself, casting off all restraint and authority of God. That usurper of Christ's throne will be allowed to continue in that place of defiance of God and absolute rule over the people for the allotted time, 42 months or 3.5 years. Then also a second beast will arise simultaneously with the first. He will come from the earth, the Jews. He figures the false prophet, but a beast as God views him. The horns as a lamb signify power as Christ, the true Lamb of God. The fact that there are two beasts simply means that both apostatized Judaism as well as Christendom accept and follow him. Though he speaks as a dragon, the mouthpiece, oracle of Satan, the archenemy of God, yet they discern him not. He influences all the dwellers on the earth and constrains them to make an image of the first beast, the usurping counterfeit king, to which by his mighty dragon power he gives breath, so that the image apparently lives and speaks. That miraculous parody of the coming of Christ, that abomination of desolation, is set up in the holy place in the temple, and worship of it is demanded of Israel. Then it will be woe to the inhabitants of the earth, for that desolator, as well as the dragon who energizes him, will have but a short time to do his worst. The closing words of encouragement have special reference to the disciples in that time of tribulation so severe and yet so brief. With every day numbered, Satan cannot go beyond 1 hour of that measured off time, which will be shortened 250 days for the elect's sake. Matthew 24:22. If those days would continue the full 3.5 years, no flesh should be saved. See our study on Daniel. Through all that time of marvelous happenings, as well as dreadful suffering, the preaching of the kingdom gospel will be going out regardless of all the distress and opposition, as a witness unto all nations. God will give the whole world a positive warning of the end of all its boasted pomp and power, as well as an opportunity to yield to Christ, the King of Kings and Lord of Lords. That testimony is symbolized by the angel flying in the midst of heaven, carrying the everlasting gospel, saying, "Fear God and give glory to him, for the hour of his judgment is come." Revelation 14:6. The Lord emphatically warns against any attempt to mislead or induce the Jews to follow after a Christ who comes secretly or on the earth in any place. He, the true Messiah, will not so come. He will come openly, not secretly, as the judge of the nations and the helper of his besieged people, the Jews. The need of his suffering people will call for action and decisive, open interposition. In this character, he will come as the lightning, sudden, swift, blazing all through the heavens, in unsurpassing judgment of all unrighteousness. His long-suffering patience will have run its course. The shepherd's rod will turn to a scepter of might and destroy the destroyers of his people and the usurpers of his kingdom. As the ruler of the Fifth World Empire, he must first take the reins of government from the hands of the Gentiles. Their times will have been fulfilled 7 years previously. This statement may appear startling to some, but we are assured of the fact. When Christ, as the Lion of the tribe of Judah, a Jew, takes his seat upon his throne in the heavens, the years of Gentile supremacy will be at an end. That will mark the beginning of the Lord's day and the end of man's day, according to God's reckoning. For when the scepter is in the hands of the root and the offspring of David, then the times of the Jews will have begun. When God gave the world rulership into the hands of Nebuchadnezzar, Jeremiah 27, the king of Judah was a usurper as well as all other rulers who did not yield to him. That marked the beginning of the times of the Gentiles, and the end of the times of the Jews, if we may so speak. Therefore, when the scepter returns to Judah in the person of Christ, the King of the Jews, the tables will be turned. Then the King of the Gentiles, the world powers, will be the usurper, for the heavens do rule, as Nebuchadnezzar found to his sorrow for a time, but later to his good. Daniel 4. The above monarch, Nebuchadnezzar, the first king of the first Gentile world power, is a most marvelous type of the last king of the last Gentile world power. He takes all the glory of his great kingdom and the world conquest to himself, although God had explicitly informed him by his prophet that he had been given the dominion by the God of heaven. Daniel 2, verse 37. For this pride and rebellion of heart he was punished for 7 years, made to eat grass as the ox, no doubt his reason dethroned. And in all of this, a most striking figure of the last world emperor, who as a beast will ignore the great God, ruler of the universe, who had given to the Gentiles the world scepter, but reserved to himself the right to withdraw it in his due time. This, the final Gentile ruler, will refuse to acknowledge. Instigated and filled with Satan, he will endeavor to hold the place in defiance of God. He will apparently succeed for 3.5 years and reign as absolute sovereign upon earth, while God's anointed is sitting on his throne in the heavens, though he is not yet acknowledged upon earth. In Psalm 2, David gives us a graphic word picture of that time. Why do the heathen rage and the people imagine a vain thing? The kings of the earth set themselves, the united world power, and the rulers take counsel together against the Lord and against his anointed, saying, Let us break their bands asunder and cast away their cords from us. He that sitteth in the heavens shall laugh. The Lord shall have them in derision. Psalm 2, verses 1 through 4. Rebellion and anarchy against God and his king are depicted in this psalm. But listen to God's answer to this usurping, defiant attitude. He that sitteth in the heavens shall laugh. The Lord shall have them in derision. What is their puny strength, though it is the united power of the world, when matched against Jehovah's strong right arm? At that time he will already have set his king upon his holy hill of Zion, as the following verses indicate, and will sit back and let them gather together and set themselves against him, but they will not prosper. Christ will roar out of heaven. He will break them with a rod of iron and dash them in pieces like a potter's vessel. Psalm 2, verses 9 through 11. Oh, that the kings were wise and would take instruction and bow their knees to God's rightful ruler, and escape the awful destined end which lies before the devil and before all the rebellious and ungodly who follow his pernicious ways. David's own experience upon the throne is a further proof that when Christ's reign begins, the rule of the Gentiles will end, that is, according to God. David was crowned king over Judah immediately upon the death of Saul, whose reign aptly figures the times of the Gentiles, and he reigned 7 years before the whole nation accepted him. Furthermore, there was a usurper, Ish-bosheth, man of shame, who claimed the throne of Saul, but God and David both ignored him, which was not the case in regard to Saul. He was the appointed ruler for an appointed time, but when it was ended, God had another anointed king, David, ready. He was not of the lineage of the house of Saul, all of which is fragrant of prophetic truth. Note also in this connection that the only mention of the phrase, times of the Gentiles, Luke 21:24, is relative to the length of time of the captivity of the Jews. One is measured by the other. When the captivity of the Jews ends, the times of the Gentiles ends also. At that point in their history, God expects them to not only acknowledge their failure to worthily represent him, but also to yield up the world's sovereignty to his anointed, the King of the Jews, the man of his choice, who will fittingly represent him, but that they will refuse to do. As we said, the usurping Antichrist will demand worship, which, if not forthcoming, will bring speedy suffering and death. Then will come the day of great tribulation, so great that Jeremiah says, as also our Lord repeats, there is not like it. It is even the time of Jacob's trouble, but he shall be saved out of it. Jeremiah 30, verse 7, by the swift coming of Christ. His return will be ushered in by signs throughout the world. The stars shall fall from heaven. All nature, apparently on the verge of ruin, will need a stronger than creature hand to save it from utter collapse. Then shall appear the sign from heaven for which the unbelieving Jews had asked. The Son of Man, once crucified, but now seen in the darkened sky, coming in the clouds of heaven to deliver his almost despairing people. He himself will be the sign. They shall look on him whom they have pierced. Every eye shall see him, not by faith nor in vision, but with their physical eyes they shall look on a real man of flesh and bones. Then shall all the tribes of the earth mourn, no doubt referring to the nations, the 12 tribes. Joseph and his brethren shall meet again. Then Israel shall be gathered from the four winds of heaven where they have been scattered by the divine edict. But angel hands or redeemed glorified men shall call them back to God with a great sound of a trumpet. Joseph's, Christ's, bowels will yearn over his people as he will view them in their homeland, a new creation no more to roam. Genesis 43, verse 30. That will all be done suddenly as the great prophet impresses upon his auditors. The fig tree is again used as the illustration of Judah, but hear of her revival. Now learn a parable of the fig tree. When his branch is tender and putteth forth leaves, ye know that summer is nigh. Matthew 24, verse 32. The fruit is there on the fig tree after the leaves. Thus, the teaching is obvious, Israel's hopes will come to sudden fruitage when their great kinsman Redeemer takes up their cause. Sit still, my daughter, until thou know how the matter will fall, for the man will not be in rest until he have finished the thing this day, as Naomi said to her daughter-in-law, Ruth 3:18. The very generation that sees the beginning of those wondrous events will be in evidence at their close. The suddenness of the final results is the point that he is emphasizing, also that the Jewish race will be in evidence. But as the days of Noah were, so shall also the coming of the Son of Man be. For as in the days before the flood they were eating and drinking and marrying and giving in marriage, until the day Noah entered into the ark, and knew not until the flood came and took them all away, so shall also the coming of the Son of Man be. Matthew 24, verses 37 through 39. The suddenness of the coming of the Lord is herein revealed. It is that which makes it more impressive. The time of that event will be known only to the Father. It will be a surprise to the world and as unwelcome as a thief, even as was the flood. It came sweeping suddenly upon the ungodly in Noah's day and took them away in judgment. In the end, it will be separative and selective of its objects. Then shall two be in the field, the one shall be taken and the other left. Two women shall be grinding at the mill, the one shall be taken and the other left. Matthew 24, verses 40 and 41. This reveals the separation between saint and sinner that will be in evidence. It defines the time as that of separation. The day of judgment will show plainly who is a believer and who is not. The one who will not believe will be taken away in judgment, even as the illustration in Noah's day emphasizes. The flood took them away. Those who believe will be left for blessing in the earth, even as was the case with Noah and his family. The earth will be purified by judgment, for wheresoever the carcass is, there will the eagles be gathered together. Matthew 24:28. To the whole world, except to the real believers on Jesus, the coming of the Lord will be unwelcome. It will entail separation in every sense of the word. But know this, that if the good man of the house had known in what watch the thief would come, he would have watched and would not have suffered his house to be broken up. Matthew 24:43. Readiness for his coming is the absolute requirement to escape from judgment. The Son of Man is coming in such an hour as men think not. They will not believe his word, therefore they will not be looking for him. Judgment will surely come upon them. Then follows some parables which enforce and emphasize the same facts concerning the advent of the Lord, the need of being ready, and the inevitable separation. It will be between saints and sinners, between servants and servants, between saints and saints, between possessors and professors, and between nations and nations. Notice the following part of the discourse. The above facts are made more impressive by the following words, as to the secrecy maintained concerning the end time, not even the angels knowing of that day and hour, hidden from all but the Father, though the Son is not mentioned here as being in ignorance. The meaning is plainly evident that the world will be taken by surprise, just as we are the case in the days of Noah. Judgment, sharp, sudden, and decisive, will sweep upon them. As at other times, judgment will be an occasion of separation. They will not all be destroyed. There will be two in the field, two at the mill. One shall be taken away in the devastating flood, while the other will find mercy and be left for blessing in the earth. It will prove the nearness of the ties that will be snapped, the apparent close relationship that will obtain in business and trade between saint and sinner, even as it is today. The earth must have her purging time, then will come her purification. The vultures will help clean house for the Lord after the great judgment supper. Revelation 19:17. The night watches. Watch therefore, for ye know not what hour your Lord doth come. But know this, that if the good man of the house had known in what watch the thief would come, he would have watched and would not have suffered his house to be broken up. Therefore be ye also ready, for in such an hour as ye think not, the Son of Man cometh. Matthew 24:42-44. The Master enjoins upon his disciples the need of watching, for the reason that they know not the day of his coming. They were not to be as the world, to whom his visit would be as welcome as the thief in the night, and far more destructive and despoiling to the temple which they counted their own. Be ye ready, he urges, for his coming is sure. Then follow some parables which all relate to the end time with its different phases. The program of the 7 years of Daniel 9:27 is given here as a period of night and darkness. It is expressed by the night watches. Notice the next verse. This agrees with Joel 2:1 and Zephaniah 1:15. A time of darkness and gloominess and thick darkness. Luke 12:38 mentions the second watch and the third watch, and Mark 6:48 names the fourth watch, in which the Lord will be revealed from heaven to deliver his people Israel from the international tempest. Otherwise, no flesh would be saved in that dreadful hour. Note carefully that a watch and an hour are used here interchangeably. But the word hour, like other figures of measurement, is used also to express a long period. For example, in John 5:28-29, it is 1,000 years long. Likewise, in Psalm 90:4, the millennial age is mentioned as a watch of the night with the Lord. We must learn its length in every case by the context. Accordingly, the hour of temptation or trial in Revelation 3:10 is another way of expressing the great tribulation mentioned in Matthew 24:21. Parables of the Olivet Discourse. In the following part of the great prophetic outline of the end time, we have three parables which show us the relation of the coming of Christ to the church. but they are in veiled language. First, faithful or unfaithful servant. Second, readiness or unreadiness, the five wise and five unwise virgins. And third, use or misuse of entrusted talents, Matthew 25, verses 14 through 30. The principles herein contained are applicable to any time and any of the Lord's people, while the things of God are in the hands of men. The true and the false, the wholehearted and the indifferent, the active and the indolent are all seen mingled together. Only at his coming will there be the purging or separating time. This not only of sinner from saint, but also of saint from saint, a separation even from those who are professedly of the household of faith. Furthermore, in each of these three parables or illustrations, we have a distinct phase of judgment seen, and all in view of the Lord's coming. The Lord is seen in different characters in these veiled narratives, each one having special significance to the church age, which will be just about closing, as the Jewish people will be coming into their own place again. One age overlaps another. While the times of the Gentiles are over at the beginning of the week of Daniel 9:27, yet we must distinguish between the fullness of the Gentiles, which will not have come in until later, Romans 11:25. The phrase fullness of the Gentiles relates to the called out from among the Gentiles, and the numbers of these are not given, neither are there any set times for the church. The limit of her days are hidden in God. In the first parable, we have emphasis as to the responsibility of ministers or shepherds of the flock of Christ. True and false service is commented upon, the governing object all through being the coming of the Lord. The value the chief shepherd puts upon the ministry of those who distribute the food to the household in due season is emphatically declared. Some are good stewards, even as Paul. They give the word suitable for the time, that is truth, which the Lord here calls meat, relating to the end time in which they are living. Consequently, they teach and preach accordingly. Blessed is that servant whom his Lord, when he cometh, shall find so doing, Matthew 24:46. He will even set him over all that he has, that is, this faithful servant shall reign jointly with his Lord. It is service, as we have seen long since, that qualifies us for rulership, but a love service, not a hireling or labored service. Love seeketh not her own, 1 Corinthians 13:5. It is only as the fallen creature that we seek our own in God's things. Therefore, there is no reward hereafter for such. Verily, they get their reward now. In heaven there will be no such service, and we prepare here for great places of trust there. We are qualifying even now, acquiring greater ability to serve more unselfishly, unsparingly of ourselves. It is in this manner that we are fitted for the higher, fuller service during the coming age, reaping even as we have sown, for this is the law of the harvest. There is truly a reaping time for those who love the household of faith and seek to feed them, not only with milk, but also with meat in due season, that they may be established. But there is, sad to say, the other side and other class of servants that also have a day of reaping. The Master bids us consider them also, for if that evil servant shall say in his heart, My Lord delayeth his coming, Matthew 24:48. Observe that his conduct now is the result of his words, which are the expression of the unbelief of his heart. He begins to smite his fellow servant and eat and drink with the drunken, two things which show the state of his heart. He opposes the faithful servant who is giving the meat in season and has no fellowship with the worldly, pleasure-seeking professed Christians. Notice he eats and drinks with the drunken, though it is not said that he is drunken himself, which would argue that he is a believer in a sense, but not a faithful servant. We would judge that we have a perfect counterpart of these two servants with us today. There are some who are preaching truth for the times, latter rain, healing, the Lord's coming, as well as separation from the world, religious and otherwise, in view of such salvation. Others oppose with all their united powers all or some of these plain statements of Scripture. Consequently, their conduct is lax and worldly. They want God, but they want a portion in the world also, in the world where the Son of God, the Creator, had not where to lay his head. Again, we emphasize the fact that this servant's conduct is all the result of his unbelief in the Lord's return.